It's great to be back at the ANU, where almost 30 years ago I was just embarking on my study of botany just across the campus, and I decided to throw in just a little economics on the side for some good measure. And it turned out that I had a slight dislike of some of the compulsory chemistry classes that the were required to finish my botany degree, and so I decided to head down that side path, and that's brought me here today. Tonight, I want to talk to you about the effects of monetary policy on the economy. Interest rates. Interest rates have been at very low levels for some time, yet economic growth in Australia is below trend. The unemployment rate is relatively high, and domestic inflationary pressures are well contained. Now, this is expected to remain the case for a time. And so I think it's only natural then to ask whether monetary policy is somehow less effective than it has been in the past. Going back 20 years ago, it was Stephen Grenville, who was in my role, my current role at that time. He gave a pretty comprehensive account of what we knew and what we didn't know about the transmission of monetary policy in Australia. So for the title of my talk today, which by the way is up on the bank's website, I've stolen a little from his title, Monetary Policy Transmission, What's Known and What's Changed. And the title there is picking up the notion that the structure of the economy has changed in a number of ways over the past 20 years, and that may have altered the way in which the transmission mechanism is working. So I think it's timely on those two counts to consider how the monetary policy transmission mechanism is operating in the current environment. Let me just give you a brief overview of some of the theory. So in responding to cyclical developments and inflation pressures, monetary policy has a significant influence on aggregate demand and on inflation. And the transmission of rates through the economy can roughly be described as follows, and I'm just going to take and focus on the case of an easing in monetary policy. So first, the Reserve Bank lowers the overnight cash rate. Second, financial markets, they update their expectations about the future path of cash rates. And then the structure of deposit and lending rates, they're quickly altered. Third, over time, households and firms respond to lower rates by increasing their demand for credit, reducing their saving, and increasing their demand for goods, services, and assets such as housing and equities. And then fourth, other things equal, rising demand increases the prices of non-tradable goods and services, and the price-setting behaviour of firms, that depends on demand conditions as well as the cost of their inputs, including of labour. And higher aggregate demand, of course, leads to increased demand for labour and, in time, a rise in wages. Now, the transmission mechanism depends crucially on how monetary policy affects both households' and businesses' expectations. It's their expectations about the future path of the cash rate. Those will affect, as I've suggested, financial market prices and returns, asset prices, and the expected prices of goods, services, and factors of production, such as labour. And expectations of more persistent changes in the cash rate, well, they're going to have larger effects. Now, the extent to which lower interest rates lead to extra demand, that's going to depend very much on how households and businesses alter their behaviours regarding borrowing and investing, as well as consuming and saving. And these responses are often described as occurring via a number of different channels. So let me just step through some of those channels. Well, we're a small open economy, so let me start with the exchange rate channel. The exchange rate channel is one way in which interest rates affect demand. Lower interest rates, they contribute to an exchange rate depreciation by reducing the returns to and therefore the demands for domestic assets relative to those assets in foreign that are denominated in foreign currency terms. And a depreciation increases the prices of foreign products relative to our domestic products. Well, that's going to lead to a switching of demand towards the domestically produced goods and services. Many macroeconomic models, they emphasise the intertemporal substitution as the primary transmission channel. Households and businesses, they make decisions about whether to save more or less now so as to spend more or less later. Lower interest rates, they're going to provide less reward for saving here and now, and thereby encouraging more expenditure, at least in the near term. Decreases in interest rates, they'll boost asset prices. That can have a number of effects. First, it boosts investment in housing, in equipment, in other capital goods, because it becomes less expensive to build those than to buy. Less expensive to build than to buy the existing assets. Second, households typically respond to an increase in their net worth by consuming a little more at each point in time. This is known as the wealth channel, which appears important in the Australian context. And then third, the balance sheet channel, that's closely related. Rising net worth, that makes it easier to borrow because higher collateral values, that makes the lending a less risky proposition. Now, another channel is the cash flow channel, and that's a channel that appears to be an important part of the transmission mechanism in Australia. So obviously, changes in interest rates, that affects households and businesses' cash flows. If they face liquidity or borrowing constraints, then an increase in their cash flows, well, that's going to typically lead to more spending. For example, a decrease in interest rates, that's going to lower interest payments for households who have variable rate mortgages, and that's going to leave them with more disposable income in their pockets. At the same time, cash flows are going to be lower than otherwise for those with interest-earning assets, and they may choose to restrict their spending. Anyway, notwithstanding that latter effect, decreases in interest rates can be expected to increase demand through this channel. And that reflects the fact that the household sector as a whole in Australia is a net borrower. More precisely, and I'll come to this later in some of my slides, what I mean by that is that its interest-bearing liabilities are greater than its interest-earning assets. And I think perhaps more importantly, it seems plausible that the marginal propensities to consume, to spend, are generally higher for the debtors who face credit constraints than they are for creditors. So that's just a rough sketch of the theory. What can we say about it in practice? And how may it have changed over time? Well, I'm sure many of you who study macroeconomics know that it's very difficult to estimate the strength of the monetary policy transmission mechanism, even in terms of its overall effect on the economy. I think it's harder still to separately try and pick it apart, to separately identify the strength of each of these sort of different channels. And a key challenge, of course, in many studies of economics is to disentangle the effects of, in this case, monetary policy from all these other influences, things like foreign developments or changes in fiscal policy. So that requires models that simultaneously account for these and other forces. I could have talked through a wide range of different model estimates from which we could choose, each of them capturing different aspects about the way in which the world works in reality. But for illustrative purposes, I'm going to just focus on one. Let me just mention it's one set of recent estimates provided by some of my colleagues at the bank using a so-called dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model. Let's just consider, as this chart shows, the estimated effects of a decrease in the cash rate of 100 basis points. So in the first quarter one, the bank cuts the cash rate by 100 basis points. Well, this is estimated to lead GDP growth to be higher than otherwise, higher than its steady state value, by between about 1/2 and 3/4 of a percentage point over the course of about 2 years. Inflation, it's estimated to rise in this model by something less than 0.25%. We like to talk in the bank in 0.25% terms, so something a bit less than that in terms of inflation per annum over 2 to 3 years. Those estimates aren't exactly the same as other models, but they're close to those of other models. I think perhaps more interesting, given the topic of my talk today, estimates from this DSG model, they tentatively suggest that the overall effect of monetary policy hasn't really changed very significantly in recent years. So what we can do is look at the estimates of the endogenous relationships in the model based on data just up to 2008 and then compare them to estimates of the model over the full history of data up to the present day. And what that suggests is that those estimates are about the same. It doesn't really matter if we chop off the most recent year's worth of data. So that suggests that the period of below-trend growth in GDP over the past few years may not reflect a change in the monetary policy transmission mechanism. I think rather the model attributes below-trend growth to sizable exogenous forces or shocks. So the sharp fall in commodity prices, that's played an important role of late. Also weakness in private investment, particularly of mining investment, that's made a sizable contribution to below-trend growth. The model also suggests that consumption growth, and I'll come back to this a little bit later, consumption growth's been a bit weaker than in the past. So those estimates, they provide some tentative evidence that the overall effect of monetary policy is neither more nor less effective than in the past. However, it may be that it's just too early. It's too early to identify any structural change with the data to hand. Alternatively, maybe the effect of monetary policy on overall activity and inflation might be close to its historical average. But that could mask some changes in its effects across different parts of the economy, or variation in the relative strength of the different channels that I've talked about from one episode to the next. So I want to consider that possibility by looking more closely at the behaviour of two things, dwelling construction and household consumption. And you'll notice I've left to one side the effects of monetary policy on business investment and external trade. I've spoken quite a bit about business investment of late, so that's one reason for putting it to the side. And I'll just note, though, that a further rise in the growth of household expenditure, a further rise in that should contribute in time to a pickup in non-mining business investment. So too would a further depreciation of the exchange rate. That, as I've said, would raise demand for domestic production. And we've noted at the bank and argued that a further exchange rate depreciation, that appears likely, that appears necessary, particularly given the large declines in commodity prices this year. So let me turn to dwelling construction. The total for dwelling construction shown here in the blue line, and then that's just split between new dwellings, and the other component in residential construction is alterations and additions. Just focusing on the aggregate for a moment. Well, dwelling construction, that's typically the most interest rate sensitive component of expenditure in the Australian economy. As you can see here from the blue line, of late it's been growing pretty strongly in response to low rates. It's been rising by about 9% over the past year. So that's a reasonable pace. If we looked at results of standard single equation, just reduced form models, they would suggest that the response of residential construction in the blue line here to lower interest rates and higher house prices, that response is broadly consistent with historical experience. Now, although the behaviour of construction over the past few years is not unusual, it's possible, though, that with a period of very low rates, there'll be some limit as to how much demand for dwelling construction we can bring forward from the future to the present day. It's also possible that a period of very low rates will eventually lead to higher inflation for land and construction work, and that's normally required, of course, to bring forth the supply of any particular good or service. So those pressures might arise from a depletion of suitable land available for development or a need to attract more developers, more workers into the industry. In such circumstances, any further increases in construction demand, what would that do? Well, that would just push up the prices of existing and new dwellings. That could occur via an increase in the land price, construction wages, developers' margins, or some combination of all three. So if we, in those circumstances, the direct effect of additional demand for construction on economic activity, well, that would be less than in the case if we had ample spare capacity. But it would nevertheless still provide some support to aggregate demand in other ways, including via the operation of the balance sheet and the wealth channels, which I've spoken of. So what sort of evidence do we have that's relevant to this question? Well, this is one chart that was shown that I think is quite interesting. It's the greenfield land supply, so newly cleared land that's ready for development, and it shows the estimated number of months of supply available for sale, but it's shown as a share of the average number of lots sold per month over the preceding year. So this is sort of the stock that's out there as a share of the sales of the preceding year. So in some cities, I think you can see here, the stock of unsold lots for suitable development, that appears to be pretty low. Shortages are most evident, perhaps not surprisingly, in Sydney, where greenfield land releases, they haven't kept pace with recent strong demand. Also, some of the bank's liaison contacts, they're concerned about the stock of suitable sites for apartment developments in Sydney, that has been depleted in the past few years. So some evidence of a tightening in supply in places. But there's little evidence of labour supply constraints outside of just a few trades and professional roles. But it is true that inflation of building material prices has risen, and the bank's liaison suggests some builders have increased margins over the past year or so. And consistent with that, inflation in new dwelling costs, that's risen to be about 2 percentage points above its average over the inflation targeting period. Okay, so it's risen, but it's still below that which was seen when dwelling construction was particularly strong in the early 2000s. So despite the potential emergence of some constraints affecting the supply of new dwellings in parts of the country, in pockets of the country, there appears to be scope for strong growth in new dwelling construction in other parts of the country. Let me just come back to this chart. I think the other thing to note is alterations and additions. Activity there could pick up. That activity used to account for about 45% of total dwelling construction, but that share has declined over the past few years, at least recorded by this data, despite lower interest rates and a sizable increase in dwelling prices. So there's scope for that to rise. In short, on dwelling construction, there's some signs of a tightening supply conditions in pockets of the country, but dwelling construction overall is responding to low interest rates, much as it's always done. What about the effects of low interest rates on household consumption? Again, we can just model this in a really simple way, link household consumption to disposable income and household wealth. In such a model, lower interest rates, well, how do they work? They affect consumption. They affect consumption indirectly by increasing household disposable income and boosting housing and equity prices. So that sort of simple model, and much as I suggested with the DSG model earlier, those results provide some tentative evidence that consumption growth, even though it's picked up a little bit since 2013, consumption growth has been a bit weaker over recent years than suggested by historical experience. I think if you look at this period and you know about the history of at least the time shown here, much of that history captures the period of adjustment to very much easier access to credit, starting from the early 90s here and right through to the mid-2000s. So at that time, household indebtedness, and I'll show you a chart of that later, household indebtedness increased very substantially, and the savings ratio, as you can see here in red in the lower panel, that declined to be well below earlier norms, at least on these measures, touching zero at some points. So in a way, the experience sort of this period, more recent years, in a way, that could be regarded as the more standard response. Indeed, the behaviour of late appears more sustainable than that, certainly, of the previous episode. So one aspect of that change in behaviour is evident in this chart, which shows households injecting equity into the housing stock over recent years. So housing equity withdrawal is a positive number here. You can see a lot of withdrawal over this period, but of late households have been injecting equity. What does that mean? Well, it means that their net new spending on housing assets, that spending has exceeded their borrowing secured over housing. And what's been an equity injection over recent years stands in very much in stark contrast to the period in the early 2000s, in the first half of the 2000s, which saw households withdrawing housing equity, and that was helping them to finance consumption. So if we go back to consumption, we see consumption was running along pretty strongly during that period, and some of that was being financed by this housing equity withdrawal. So as I just mentioned, the experience of recent years, that's characterised by slightly lower growth of consumption than might have been expected. However, while that's true, lower growth of consumption, the responsiveness of consumption to disposable income, to wealth, those things don't appear to have changed, at least in a statistically significant way. So there's two possible explanations, in at least that I could come up with for that observation. The first is that growth of consumption of late could be affected by factors other than the stance of monetary policy. And the second is that it may be the strength of these various monetary policy transmission channels affecting consumption has changed, but in ways that are difficult to identify using the models of aggregate household behaviour. And it's hard to be definitive, but my sense is both of those things are true. Other factors, other than monetary policy, but possible changes in some aspects of the transmission channels. Let's start with considering that by looking at changes which are affecting the cash flow channel. So that's what this chart's designed to do. It shows the effect of a decrease of 100 basis points in the cash rate on net interest payments of households as a share of income. And it shows it changing over time. So net interest payments of households, as this shows, are now much more responsive to changes in interest rates than they were a decade or more ago. So if we decrease interest rates, net interest payments for households fall. They're paying less off their mortgages, for example. Right, so at the same time, we've heard quite a lot about a noticeable increase in households' holding of interest-earning assets. I'll come back to that chart in a minute, but here in the blue line shows assets that the households hold that are earning interest. So since about the time of the global financial crisis, those assets have increased as a share of their disposable income. The effect of that can be sort of discerned through the fact that this line's a little bit higher than it had been. But that sort of movement is nothing compared to the change in the cash flow effect compared to the early 90s. So despite that rise in assets which are earning interest as a share of incomes, the cash flow effect is still larger than it was the effect on cash flows of a change in interest rates is larger than it was in the early 90s. And that reflects a substantial increase in housing credit from the early 1990s to the mid-2000s. In other words, the big rise in the red line here over this period. So I think, jumping around a bit here, but going back to this one, by itself, the greater responsiveness of these net interest payments, these cash flows, implies that the cash flow channel should be stronger now than it was previously. Other things equal, we might have expected that the stronger effect of interest rates on the average household's cash flows and the operation of these other channels of monetary policies, that they would have encouraged a more noticeable rise in debt more noticeable than the red line has risen here over recent years. And a larger increase in current consumption in response to these very low interest rates. That's what we might have expected. And yet household indebtedness, it's moved a bit, but it's been relatively stable for some years now. So while low interest rates have helped to support consumption and debt, other forces appear to have been working in this opposite direction. Moreover, the response of consumption, the response of indebtedness, that's going to depend on how different types of households are responding to these forces. And I'm going to try and make that clearer with just a few examples. Well, let me start with households. Some households that may have revised down their expectations for income growth, and those households may also be more uncertain about their incomes. That sort of outcome is certainly consistent with a substantial decline in wage growth and the rise in unemployment that we've seen, the unemployment rate that we've seen over the past few years. So that could have caused that change in their expectations and that uncertainty. That could have caused some of those households to have become uncomfortable with the levels of debt that they had been carrying. Accordingly, many households may have decided to pay down their debts faster than they would have in a world of unchanged expectations about incomes. And that sort of action would have contributed to a period of weaker consumption growth than otherwise. But in such an environment, lower interest rates, what are they doing? Well, they're helping to facilitate any such deleveraging by these households. They're hastening the time at which those households will eventually feel more secure about their financial situation. Do we have any evidence of that? Well, there is some evidence of households, in fact, quite a few households behaving in this way. In particular, the rate of mortgage prepayments, paying ahead of schedule, that's increased as interest rates have fallen, and more households are well ahead of their required schedule of repayments, as shown in this chart. I don't have a long history to compare to earlier episodes, but it's consistent with that sort of behaviour, what we see here. So, just to clarify, that liabilities line that I showed you before is the same total household debt. I've just called it household debt here. And it's shown as a percent of household income. So that's the line that was fluctuating around 150% before. That's the bold red line at the top. But what if we deduct funds which are held by households in their mortgage offset accounts? That's shown in the dashed lines just under these, going back for the last few years. So if we deduct those and ignore investor credit for a moment in blue, what we're left with, this dashed line here, the rest of household credit, that's declined by about 4 percentage points as a share of household disposable income since about early 2010. So since about this point, that dashed line, it's not much lower, but it's about 4 percentage points lower. It's certainly not higher. So that's consistent with the degree of deleveraging among some households, particularly when we consider that low interest rates might otherwise have encouraged a general increase in this type of credit over that period. What about those households that rely on the interest-bearing assets? Let me talk about them for a minute. Well, if they rely on interest-bearing assets, their disposable incomes are lower than otherwise, given the sizable decline in interest rates of late. And accordingly, such households may be reluctant to maintain consumption, either by running down their pool of liquid assets or accessing capital gains that they may have enjoyed on any housing or equities that they hold. They might be reluctant to do that. And if they were, such behaviour would contribute to the growth of aggregate consumption being a little bit less responsive to a decline in interest rates than in the past. Finally, let's consider those households with some spare funds to invest. The very low level of interest rates, that may have prompted such households to search for yield. And many of these households have combined some of those spare funds with some new debt to purchase housing for the purposes of investment. So that's shown in the blue line down here. Indeed, the strong growth of investor housing loans has driven the growth in overall household debt. over recent years and contributed to a rise in both housing prices and dwelling construction. And even though that's not going to directly contribute to a rise in consumption of the households who are doing that investment, it's going to support economic activity nonetheless. So let me draw a few conclusions here. Monetary policy, in my mind, is working to support demand, although it's working against some strong headwinds. So these include the significant decline in mining investment, fiscal consolidation at state and federal levels, and the exchange rate, which continues to offer less assistance than would normally be expected in achieving balanced growth in the economy. Now, model estimates that control for these forces and other forces, they provide some tentative evidence that the monetary policy transmission mechanism, at least in aggregate, is about as effective as usual. But it may be too early. It may be too early to pick up a statistically significant change using such models. As usual, dwelling construction is growing strongly in response to low interest rates, and this is making some contribution to growth of aggregate demand, to growth of employment. It may be that in some parts of the country, any further substantial increases in residential construction activity might run up against some supply constraints that would put further upward pressure on housing prices. And as the banks noted for some time now, large increases in housing prices, if accompanied by strong growth of credit, a relaxation of lending standards, those things are a potential risk for economic stability. And accordingly, the bank is working with other regulators, particularly APRA, to assess and contain such risks that may arise from the housing market. Consumption growth, I showed you, consumption growth has picked up a bit since 2013, but it's still a little weaker than suggested by historical experience. And I've suggested that this may reflect a number of factors, including some variation in the ways that the different channels of policy are affecting households according to their stage in life. Some indebted households, they appear to be taking advantage of low interest rates to pay down their debts faster than has been the norm, perhaps in response to weaker prospects for income growth. Those that rely on interest receipts, they may feel compelled to constrain their consumption in response to the relatively long period of very low interest rates. And meanwhile, the search for yield is no doubt playing a role in driving the strong growth of investor housing credit. That might provide some indirect support to aggregate demand, but it's a channel that is not without risk. In short, monetary policy is working. The transmission mechanism may have changed in some respects, and this could help to explain lower than expected growth of consumption, lower than expected growth of debt of late. But it's hard, as many things in economics, it's hard to be too definitive to know more about it, about these sorts of issues. I think it would be helpful to better understand the behaviours of different types of households using household-level data. So that's a call to students to peer more deeply at things like the Hilda database. And to use a botanical analogy, a pretty simple one, albeit, I think to know more about a plant, it's very helpful to use microscopes and the like to really observe how the different cells are working, and that's probably what we need here to understand what the household sector is doing. So let me finish there, and then we'll hand over for questions. I think there's some mics coming around, and maybe Martin might direct things, but as he sees fit. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Very long, more complicated talk than I'm used to. But just looking at all the pictures and thinking about the last decade, the thing that strikes me is the great degree of stability in most of the pictures that you showed. The savings ratio, the last picture that you showed and so on. The liabilities picture, consumption. Given... let's suppose it's true that there is this great degree of stability. And then given that you've been focusing on 100 percentage basic points changes, the question that I would ask, which you may not quite want to answer, is it all suggests that a quarter, 25% basis points, isn't going to do much? Or putting it in other words, strongly that monetary policy has run its course, and roughly speaking, its impact has been pretty weak. So monetary policy has run its course, and its impact has been pretty weak. Now, obviously you won't want to answer these questions directly, but maybe you can look at me and wink occasionally, and I'll get the message.
Well, Bob, unfortunately, we're not back in labour economics just in your office with just a few of us, but and there are cameras here. No, look, I think it's a good... It's a question that's worth addressing. I mean, I think this is a little bit the point of my conclusion, that my sense is monetary policy is working, but it's working against some pretty strong forces in the other direction. It's true any 25 basis point move has a fairly modest effect by itself, but the cumulative effect of many of them done since late 2011, starting just before I came into this position, I think, you know, they are working and we do see effects. You're right, maybe we haven't seen a big pickup in consumption and only a small fall in the savings ratio, but you know, they're not totally out of line with historical experience. In some ways, this was a very special period and one that really wasn't sustainable. It was just this household sector absorbing much easier access to credit than they'd ever enjoyed before, and pushing up their debt to higher levels. And then, as you say, for about 10 years, they've been reasonably stable in the scheme of things, and that's fine. But I think, you know, interest rates are working because we've had a number of those 25 basis point sort of reductions that have accumulated over a long period of time. And I think if we tried to imagine, and indeed you can put the results in sort of models, and what the economy would be looking like if we hadn't done any of that. And it's very hard to pin down, particularly things like the exchange rate and the like. I think it would be a very different situation. We'd have a much weaker demand, no doubt much higher unemployment, weaker still wage growth than we've got. Wage growth is pretty weak. So I think you're right. Any given sort of minor fall, it's hard to sort of see through with these models much of an effect. But we've accumulated quite a few of these, and more than just 100 basis points. Let me stop there.
People should feel free to put their hand up in advance for questions. We can have a sort of overlapping generation kind of thing. The young people have a microphone while the old people are asking questions. There must be more questions. In front.
Thanks, Chris. I was wondering if you could comment a bit on the implication of lags for the making of policy. Mm. I'm sort of struck by, on the one hand, the academic literature talks about monetary policy having long and variable lags of something like 18 months to 2 years, and your chart suggested the main impact is after about a year. On the other hand, when the media talks about the Reserve Bank making monetary policy, it's often in terms of they'll move interest rates and they'll wait 2 months to see what impact it's had, and then they'll decide if they want to move more, which would seem to suggest the media thinks the lag is more like sort of 2 weeks rather than sort of 1 or 2 years.
Hmm. Well, some of that probably comes back a bit to Bob's question. So thanks for that question, John. Lags, yes, long and variable. This model, the DSG sort of results, they often suggest slightly quicker responses than you might get in some other estimates. Although I don't want to get too technical, but I'm sure there's enough economists in the audience that will grant me some license to get a bit technical. Some of those other models, things like structural VARs, for example, what do? They often assume, and they identify the effect of monetary policy by assuming it doesn't have an immediate effect on a number of variables. So they almost bake in a delayed time frame. I think it's still reasonable that these effects build over time. Whether the exact peak is within a year or takes a bit longer, 18 months, maybe even 2 years, probably within the realm of uncertainty. If you look here, even at this chart within the DSG model, the sort of the wide range of estimates between the sort of 95% confidence range is a pretty wide one. So that would accommodate many possibilities here. So I think they're long and variable. This model's a bit shorter than some. it's a bit hard to pin down. In terms of the point you're trying to make about that focus, which is over quite a long period of time, and other people's focus on you've moved, you've observed, what's the next decision, if any, within a few months. I think what that's doing, recognising though, is that any given small movement, and central banks tend to move when they can and when it's sort of things are evolving gradually in fairly measured steps, try and observe a few effects. You can't observe a lot directly on monetary policy, but it's also more a sort of getting a better sense of, were we right in thinking the economy was moving in this sort of direction when we made that earlier decision? Or have things weakened further or strengthened further? And looking for those sorts of indications to say, does it need a little bit more or can we hold steady for a while? I think that's how you sort of put those two observations together.
Thanks for your talk, Dr. Kent. It was illuminating. I just wanted to get your perspective on perhaps how the structure of the economy had changed, for example, the financial sector. So the way I'm envisioning this is perhaps there's a change in the cash rate, and as you mentioned, ordinarily we would expect players in the financial markets to adjust their expectations of the future time path of interest rates. Now, what I'd like to ask is there any evidence that this path or this mechanism has remained the same over time? So we've got banks which are increasingly exposed to overseas markets and wholesale funds markets abroad. So does this weaken that aspect of the transmission of monetary policy?
I don't think it does. If you look at the evidence, changes in the cash rate, they don't need to move one for one through to, say, borrowing and lending rates that businesses and households observe in the economy. And indeed, we often hear, when they don't, particularly over the course of us cutting rates, we hear a lot about times when the full cash rate reduction hasn't been passed through to customers. We don't hear quite as often when they pass through more of it, and sometimes that happens as well. Indeed, if we go back to this period, this big transition in debt levels, one of the things that was happening, one aspect of the easier access to credit, was a big reduction in margins charged on housing loans over things like the cash rate over a long period of time. So that was increased competition in the financial sector, which can often drive a difference between the cash rate and the borrowing rate that households face. But more or less over recent years, you know, they're not one for one, the pass-through to the rates that people care about from the cash rate. But ostensibly, you know, they do move pretty closely. There are times, like during the GFC, when there were these pressures, these offshore pressures and changes in wholesale markets that were putting pressure on the banks, that meant they weren't passing through in quite the same degree of precision. But the board can account for that when they're setting the cash rate. So more or less moving as you'd expect and pretty closely.
Okay, so then would I be right in saying that you get as much bang for your change in the cash rate now as you have in the past?
Yeah, more or less, I think. I think that's a fair comment. There's a hand up down here.
Thank you, Dr. Chris Kent, for your interesting presentation. I think initially you mentioned that it seems that monetary policy is less and less effective over time, and I totally agree with that. Using time-varying parameter VAR model with not only Australian data, but also US and UK and Canada data, I totally agree with that. But my question is that one one of the contributors to the fact that the cash rate or interest rate is decreasing over time, for all developed countries. And given that fact, then do you see any prospect of Australia going into a zero lower bound like in Japan and Euro countries, that does it mean that does it mean that that the liquidity trap is seen, right, or can be seen in the next 1 or 2 years or something like that? Thank you.
Well, I think I agree with some of your question, the premise of it, but certainly not all of it. I think the evidence for Australia is actually, if you use fairly coarse or aggregate macro models, it's hard to find evidence of a significant change in the effectiveness of monetary policy. The transmission mechanism seems more or less the same, at least statistically, with the data that we have to hand. And then I suggested a few reasons for possible changes in households' behaviour that might suggest maybe it's a little bit less effective than you might have thought given earlier history, particularly with regards to debt and consumption. So that's the first thing. But I think the part of your question that I do agree with is that rates are very low and have been very low around much of the world, particularly in the developed economies. But that reflects some very adverse effects flowing from the global financial crisis, with very weak financial systems. And, in the US, households are going through a significant deleveraging, deciding that they were just carrying too much debt, and financial institutions being very much weakened, and the public sector having to step in these countries and rescue and bail out the banking systems. Financial crises are not good things to have for growth, and those, I think, are the essence of why rates are so low and have hit the zero lower bound in those countries. Prospects of that here, well, let's hope we can avoid those sorts of extreme circumstances, and so far I think we've managed to do that. Part of the reason is I think we have a pretty flexible economy. We also have, despite what I've said about the exchange rate has been flexible and it has been moving lower as we've been facing these negative forces of lower commodity prices of late. So certainly you can never say never, and our forecasts, we're the first to say how imprecise and inaccurate they are. We do that by having these very wide fans around the sort of central paths that we publish, and that just recognises that many things are possible. But I don't think it's sort of in the, I don't think it's too likely, but I said never say never. But again, I think rates are very low here because of these other negative forces, not because monetary policy is less effective so much, but just because there are these other negative forces, and those other negative forces are much, much more substantial in some of these other countries that you talked of.
You mentioned that your liaison was telling you that there were problems with supply of available land for, I think, new apartment dwellings, and more generally there was a shortage, or the amount of land that's available in the city seems to be particularly low. Do you have any explanations for why that might be? Is there land banking going on, perhaps by foreign investors? Are councils not doing enough to make land available? Is there some sort of structural impediment in place? And perhaps a second element to that question would be, there are various sort of things that people blame for the affordability crisis, as some people call it, stamp duty being one and negative gearing being the other. How do you see those three things sort of playing together in affecting prices of houses?
I think this chart's useful, but we should take it with a little bit of a grain of salt, because it's just saying what amount of supply is there on the books at the moment available for sale, but as a share of what's been sold the previous year. And if you've been selling a lot the previous year, which I think you have, you've run down the stock that's there. Councils, of course, can choose to, going through the usual processes, add to that, but that could be a slow process if it's facing a pretty significant increase in demand for land. But having said all of that, there has been a pickup in construction and building approvals are at very high levels, including sort of brownfield developments in cities. Melbourne and Sydney stand out, but elsewhere. Australians are building more higher density apartments than they were in the past. So that's partly in response to people want to be closer to the centre of cities, partly because of these supply constraints, partly because the price of land is very high. I mean, I don't really have much to say about stamp duty. Let me say a broad or negative gearing. Let me just make a broad point that it's quite often and easy, I think, for people to focus very much on the demand side of things. Anything that pushes, makes any seemingly any individual better off in terms of more money in their pocket to spend on housing at a time when demand is fairly strong and maybe the supply is not as responsive as you might think, that's going to just push prices up. And the other thing, just let me finish with a quick fact that I don't think many people are appreciative of. You know, house prices are growing a bit faster in, I think, most cities around the country than apartment prices. And that's because apartments, we have actually been supplying a whole lot more of them. Building approvals for higher density apartments have really picked up quite a lot. So supply and demand is kind of working on that front.
Thanks, Chris. My question relates to something that Ben Bernanke said, the former Fed chairman, said after he left. It's not with regard to what he said, but he made the comment that the Fed had to be going very hard on monetary policy because he felt that the fiscal response was inadequate. That was his comment, I believe. What is the is this something unique to the US, or is there this sort of dance, to the extent that you can comment on it, is there this sort of dance in Australia between fiscal and monetary policy like we might observe in the US?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, we've made notice that there is fiscal consolidation that has been occurring and the budgets of state and federal governments have more of that coming down the line. It's fairly gradual. It hasn't changed much of late. Indeed, I think, you know, the moving from the budget last year through MIEFO and then to the budget we've just received, sort of the deterioration in the fiscal outlook reflects weaker commodity prices, weaker wage growth, and they've let that flow through the bottom line without sort of tightening up in the near term too much. So that's letting the automatic stabilisers work. That doesn't have a big implication in terms of having to adjust forecasts. I think, you know, when you've got really extreme levels of debt, as you have in parts of Europe and, you know, I wouldn't call them quite as extreme, but high levels of public debt in the US, there comes a point at which you sort of feel compelled to try and address that. And, you know, as a macroeconomist, you sort of feel like, well, do that in the future when times are better, but it's hard to convince markets and to convince the public that you're actually going to do it unless you do it, start with a bit now. I think what we're seeing here is not excessive in the history of fiscal consolidations that we've seen in the past. And, you know, the bank, rightly so, takes fiscal policy as given and tries to respond, just as we take the exchange rate that the financial markets hand us as given and respond, or what's happening on the mining investment front and try and respond as best we can.
Thank you very much again for your conversation, or your talk. I'd just like to go to the lending, where people are paying more off their loans and a higher percentage of loans that are being paid off. I would just wonder, do you think that when rates begin to rise again, whether or not you'll see that reversed, or whether or not there'll be a floor sort of put in with a change of human behaviour slightly, and whether or not with GFC sort of fresher in people's minds, whether or not that might actually reach a level and then stay there, or whether or not it will come back down and people will start feeding into their or using their redraw for consuming once the rates start to rise again, or whether or not there's perhaps a new normal.
It's possible, but I wouldn't necessarily fully ascribe it to interest rates. I think what's happened in households' minds is they've observed perhaps lower income growth than they had been used to. Wage growth, as I've suggested, is certainly lower. The unemployment rate is high. That makes people feel uneasy. And for a lower wage growth, a fixed nominal debt is a bit harder to pay off than it might have been in the past. And in response to those weakening conditions, which the banks responded to via low interest rates, people are saying, some people are saying, I'm a bit uncomfortable with the levels of debt. Maybe I'll try and make some inroads. And low interest rates help them do that. So I think what you're sort of suggesting is that the cause starts with interest rates and then goes here directly, whereas there's this other factor that's sitting in there behind it. And so when we think about a time when interest rates will ultimately, sometime off in the future, as the economy strengthens, ultimately normalise, that is going to presumably come with it more stronger wage growth, maybe a reduction in unemployment. So those better conditions might make people feel comfortable holding the debt levels at any given debt level, and it's interest rates responding to that. That's the way I think about it. Maybe I didn't explain that so clearly, but I think you've got to think about these other factors, and that's the essence of what I was trying to say in my talk. There are these other forces at work.
Chris, how do we marry your comments that the transmission mechanism is more or less working, at least we can't be sure that it's not working, it seems to be working, with those of the Governor last week, who said the marginal effect of interest rate cuts may be smaller from here on, the lower interest rates go from already very low levels. Is what the Governor said a forecast of what might happen, in other words, of this relationship deteriorating, or how do we put your two views? Yours is an entire speech. His was just a paragraph of a speech, but how do we put them together?
Well, I think the first thing is to note, as I did, maybe if things have changed, if it is becoming a little bit less effective, monetary policy, that is, it might be a bit hard to know statistically. So that's the first point. The second point, I think, is I was very much looking at what we've seen to date, and his was a comment about what might happen in the future if it was needed to see further cuts. And one of the sorts of things that both he's mentioned and I have mentioned in my talk was this behaviour by those who are earning and perhaps reliant on, let me just find, on assets which earn them interest, bank deposits. So it may be that for various reasons they're just unable or unwilling, if they feel rates are very low and likely to stay low for a long time, to eat into their savings. Maybe they don't want to or can't access capital gains if they're lucky enough to have had a house. So it may be that's the sort of household that may be responding a bit differently now just because rates have been low for a long time. But I don't see them as being inconsistent. Mine's talking about what can we see statistically using macro models that aren't very precise. Looking back at the past, his was a comment as much as anything about what if they were lower still from here, what might we expect? And it's hard to say, but here's one possible aspect where things might be a bit less effective than you would have thought, because you're impairing the incomes of a non-trivial part of the populace.